by way of introduction. My name's John Ashworth, and I used to be director of the LSE. And when I was, I wondered what it was that a former biologist, former genetic engineer, might do of an intellectual kind in the London School of Economics. And I was, of course, extremely conscious that there had been attempts to try and bring biologists and social scientists together before. One of the most serious, interestingly, being also done by a director of the LSE, William Beveridge, who indeed raised a lot of money for a chair in what was in the 1930s called sociobiology, to which he appointed Lancelot Hogben, who introduced into the corridors, alas, of the LSE, Xenopus toads. Now, anybody who's ever seen a Xenopus, they're South African claw toads, and they bear about as much relationship to the British toad as a sort of Rolls Royce does to a Mini. I mean, they are enormous, fat, extremely toad-like toads. And I discovered quite rapidly when I sort of suggested that maybe we should sort of have a little sort of biologist and sociologist get together, that in the LSE mythology, poor Lancelot and his toads still had a considerable aura. And I was told in no uncertain terms that if I wanted to add to all my other crimes that I was committing, letting more toads loose in the corridors, I would have a riot on my hands. But so we decided to skip the toad stage, and I persuaded Helena Cronin, not that she needed much persuading, to start what subsequently became known as the Darwin Seminars, which have now been running, Helena, where is she, for a couple of years?
No, just every year.
It just seems like 2 years. Which have now been running for a year, and attracting, greatly to my satisfaction, I have to say, a considerable amount of interest, not only from the social science community in London, but also more widely. And about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, Jeff Mulgan, who I've known for a long time, and whom I like to think I helped some years ago start the Demos think tank, suggested that if we were really going to be serious, we ought to just stop, do a bit of stock taking, and see whether what had been going on at the LSE for a year or so had any wider interest outside the somewhat narrow confines of academe. And so we published, or rather Demos published, earlier this week, this Demos Quarterly, which Helena and Oliver Curry edited and kindly allowed me to write a little piece at the beginning, which is some attempt to expose to a wider public the kinds of things which have been going on in under the heading of the Darwin Seminars at the LSE for the last year or so. And the purpose of this afternoon is really to have another Darwin seminar, because they're always fun, but also to promote this issue of Demos Quarterly. And what we're going to do for the next hour and 45 minutes or so is have a panel discussion. I should tell you, a number of people have written to me very kindly saying they've got questions to ask, and I'll call upon some of those just to get the proceedings going in a moment. But before we do that, let me introduce the usual eclectic LSE-type panel. On my extreme right is Sam Britton.
Samuel Britton, please.
I beg his pardon. Is Mr. Samuel Britton.
Just Samuel Britton. Why is it so difficult to get a simple name right?
Well-known financial journalist to some, but clearly not to me. And here is Jeff Mulgan, who is here in his guise as starter and leading spirit behind Demos. On my left, Michael Ignatieff, polymath, really. And on my extreme left, Colin Tudge, who, like me, started life as a biologist, but unlike me, has been much more successful at making it a popular appeal, and has, to his credit, a number of popular works, or serious popular works of biological nature, including several awards, I seem to remember, from Glaxo and people like that. And even more near misses, he said. The LSE was never humble. Now, I know Jeff wants to say something to start with, and I know Colin wants something to say something to start with, and what I'm going to do now is to ask them in turn to say what they have to say, and then I'm going to call on some of those people who I know have questions to ask, and then it's going to be a free-for-all, and I'm going to try and be chairman. Okay? In that case, Jeff, without more ado.
Okay, well, I'm going to be extremely brief because I'm painfully aware that people on the panel, A, know much more about this topic than I do, but also in the audience we have some of the cream of both British social science and of evolutionary psychology and biology. So I hope we're going to have a genuine dialogue. I just wanted to say a few words about why we, as a policy think tank, wanted to get into this field. And part of the reason for me was personal, just that although I studied social science, I'm one of those people who from an early age read popular science books and often found them much more fun to read than the books I was having to read in social science. They tended to be written more clearly, more crisply, with better examples. And it was a thing which always struck me is how big a gap there is still between the two cultures of social science and the natural sciences, and that one could read enormous swathes of economics, sociology, political science without any sense of human beings being biological or physical creatures in any way. And many of the leading figures in those fields have written violent polemics against any intrusion, as they would see it, from other fields such as biology. And I've been slightly horrified too in the last three to six months talking to quite a few senior social scientists, just discovering how little they actually understood even about the basic principles of evolution. That they were often dismissing some of the lessons coming from evolutionary psychology without having even really come to terms with the basic intellectual building blocks. Which isn't to say there aren't quite good reasons for distrust the other way. I mean, Edward Wilson, for example, who often writes marvelous books about the diversity of life and so on, also has been guilty, I think, of the worst kind of reductionism in thinking about how human beings work. And Jim Watson, who's now deeply involved in the Human Genome Project, famously said recently that intellectual labour breaks down into two categories, is all either physics and the rest is social work. Well, coming from an organisation which by that definition is engaged in social work, I can understand the suspicions. I hope with this issue, which goes through questions ranging from homicide to medicine to justice and equal opportunities, that we're doing a little bit to help bridge those gulfs and to encourage people in the social sciences, in policy more generally, to take seriously what I think is an extraordinarily fertile field of work at the moment. And in a sense, two rather different fields I think are dovetailing. One is all the work coming from Darwinism, evolutionary psychology, and the other is a rather different work coming out of Human Genome Project, mapping of all of our different genetic predispositions. Both are not guilty of the older sins of crude determinism, of trying to find a simple gene for criminality or homosexuality or whatever else it may be. But both are perhaps taking us a little bit away from older ideas about human beings' unlimited freedom, capacity to make themselves whatever they want to be. This document does not have a set of policy recommendations, and I think it would be very unwise for it to do so. In a sense, the discipline isn't yet at that stage. It is, however, throwing up some rather good questions about, for example, why we spend so much subsidising foods which we know because of our evolutionary predispositions to be bad for us. It is asking rather good questions about whether our laws should be gender blind, given what we're learning from evolutionary psychology. And it is posing some rather important questions about law and order. But most of it, it has to be said, is still fairly speculative. It's a field which is generating very intriguing hypotheses and speculations and explanations without quite so many falsifiable hypotheses yet. And that's why it's a field in maturation rather than maturity, I think. And what will be really interesting now is to see the engagement with social scientists, because in so many of the fields, the next step is the question of how do we actually cope? Having defined some of our evolutionarily determined predispositions, how do we actually cope with those? How do we actually manage our institutions, our cultures, to encourage the benign sides of our nature and discourage the more malign sides? My final point is really a very simple one, that I think there's a parallel going on between what's happened in understanding of the environment, in ecology more broadly, in setting limits to what human beings can do, limits to what the economy can do, limits to what society can do, a whole series of external limits, which have really transformed the West's and the world's worldview over the last 20 years. And in a sense, what's coming from evolutionary psychology is a parallel reshifting of our internal worldview of what we're made out of. And I think care needs to be taken that although it's a very healthy shift away perhaps from the hubris of earlier generations of liberalism about just how much we could, human nature was malleable, we also need to be careful not to go to the other extreme of determinism and fatalism. And I hope what this issue does is to open up issues and possibilities rather than to be used as ways of closing them down. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Colin.
Well, I've come across quite a few people lately who don't actually like the Darwinian studies at LSE, which I'm involved in somewhat peripherally. And the people who don't like it aren't all sociologists, in fact. Many of them are actually professors of biology, and that's what it says on their CV. But although they're professors of biology, it's obvious to me that they simply don't understand what we're up to and why we're doing it, although that doesn't stop them writing books and articles saying how misguided it is to try and look at human bodies and minds through Darwinian eyes. It's obvious, too, that their objections are not rooted simply in misunderstanding. All of the detractors also have some political and moral agenda which they feel the studies are threatening. It's a bad thing for a professor of science to misunderstand science. It's even worse to spread this misunderstanding among the public at large and pretend that it's wisdom. But it's worst of all to confuse science and politics and then pretend that you haven't. So this little introduction is aimed mainly at those detractors, partly for their edification and partly for the good of their souls. The first question every scientist ought to ask is the good old-fashioned one that never goes away: is it true? Well, the Demos book describes some of the reasons for thinking that our understanding of ourselves is enriched by applying Darwinian ideas. Those ideas do suggest hypotheses that are testable and increasingly are being tested. LSE is the home of Karl Popper, and the new studies, or at least the ones we're interested in, do meet the Popperian criterion of falsifiability, and no scientific theorizing can in fact claim more than that. So the next question is whether the insights gained, if true, are of any use. Well, let me refer to just one example, which is outlined in the Demos book. In the late 1970s, two Canadian psychologists, Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, decided to look at abuse in children. They quickly focused on homicide, reckoning that this was a form of abuse that was hardest to cover up and would yield the most accurate statistics. They predicted that stepchildren might be more at risk than true genetic offspring because of the principle of kin selection as laid out by Bill Hamilton. We dedicate ourselves to our own children because they are genetic extension of ourselves, and not just because they're small and vulnerable and we are nice. And in fact, Wilson and Daly found that children were at least 100 times more likely to be abused by step-parents, and particularly by step-fathers, than by their true genetic parents. And that the very few parents who did kill their real children were typically depressed themselves, and that the homicides were linked with suicide, whereas step-parents tended simply to beat up their stepchildren. Now this, of course, is not surprising. Ask anyone in any pub if they thought this was liable to be true, And they'd say, obviously, the world's literature from Cinderella to David Copperfield is filled with tales of uncaring or downright vicious step-parents. But as Wilson relates, most of the official statistics that they turned to investigate this very simple relationship didn't record whether the homicidal parents were genetic or were step-parents. This was true in the United States, in Canada, and in the UK. It wasn't until Daly and Wilson dug deeper themselves that they found out that there was this relationship. Yet dozens, and in some cases scores, of other risk factors had been listed, including poverty and maternal youth. Both of those factors are significant. Poor people and young mothers are more stressed, and they are more likely to take it out on their children. But step-parentage emerges by far the most important risk factor. So why hadn't this been recorded? Apparently it had never occurred to anyone, criminologists, sociologists, psychologists, whoever, that genetic relationship would make a difference. The conceit of the middle decades of this century has been that in cerebral creatures like us, so far removed from the jungle and the plain, genes don't make any difference. This wishful thinking had become dogma. It was politically perilous to venture any other opinion. So the most important risk that's faced by small children in families was simply overlooked for decades. The prediction that genetic relationship could make a difference is a Darwinian prediction. It springs from the notion of kin selection. Can anybody say, so what? And social workers the world over are notoriously overstretched. They need to deploy their efforts accurately. But while they were being told to look especially carefully at poor families and at teenage mothers, perfectly respectable middle-aged people were abusing and killing children for no other reason than a lack of genetic relationship. Not to take account of such information is, I would say, in the language of good old-fashioned moralists, a sin. To ridicule the studies that lead to this kind of insight is a misuse of academic status. If it transpires, as in this instance it already might, that these genetic studies can tighten policy and thereby save lives, then those who seek to inhibit these studies have got blood on their hands. And I think they should realise this. The broader question, of course, is how far such insights can be carried, how much of sociological practice might be modified through such studies. Can we extend the studies beyond sociology and into all descriptions of the human condition, into literature perhaps? Can Hamlet and Middlemarch usefully be looked at through Darwinian eyes? The point is that we don't yet know. George Eliot would surely have enjoyed the exercise. But there's already enough to suggest that such an approach might be very interesting indeed, and it's the job of academics to pursue interesting ideas. No one is being evangelist at this place, even though some exhibit commendable evangelical fervour. An evangelist says, I know I'm right, and you'd better listen. We're simply saying these are interesting ideas, and they could turn out in many contexts to be very important, and we think it's a good idea to pursue them. That's what academics ought to do. Absolutely not should they use their position to inhibit the pursuit of good ideas. But the detractors don't, on the whole, fight cases. They argue from what they consider to be deep principles. First, they suggest that the idea that human behaviour might be influenced to an important extent by our genetic inheritance, an inheritance that in turn was shaped in the hunting-gathering days of our ancestors, is simply implausible. Then they suggest that if it were true, which they say it simply can't be, then it would be too threatening to contemplate. So let's look at these objections. The notion that genes might underpin quite complicated sequences of behaviour is a little hard to take at first sight. It becomes easier when we consider two points. First, microchips may indeed underpin immensely complicated computer programs, full of conditional clauses. And although I'm not suggesting that brains are really like computers, we might reasonably ask, if silica could behave this implausibly, why should DNA, which after all is much more interesting stuff? Secondly, it's supremely obvious that many animals that seem almost devoid of brain, and which certainly seem unable to cogitate, can and do behave in extremely complicated ways. And there are experiments, for example, on hybridizations of birds, which show that great chunks of this behavior follow patterns of inheritance that are entirely compatible with Mendelian predictions. The question is, then is not whether behaviour can be spelled out in DNA, it obviously can and is, but the extent to which our own human behaviour is rooted in our DNA, the extent to which our genes predispose us to do this or that and in what circumstances. And this is what people at this place are trying to find out. Nobody but nobody is saying that everything we do is prescribed by our genes in the way that the behaviour of a fighter plane is prescribed by a computer. But if it really is the case, as beyond question it is, that people's behaviour is steered by their genes to some extent, then we really ought to know the extent to which this is the case and in what instances. Wilson and Daly know all about confounding variables, and when all these are taken into account, the only factor that can explain the difference between step-parents and real parents is genetic. It would be foolish a priori to suggest that genes must be the cause, But then nobody here would suggest such a thing. It's more than foolish, it's positively bad to insist a priori that this could not be the case and to stand in the way of the investigations. But then there are the threats that some detractors claim. The first threat that the detractors perceive is that of genetic determinism. This idea is so silly and out of date that it's hard to believe that those who speak of it believe it themselves. Professors of biology, one feels, really shouldn't get such simple ideas so wrong. For the idea of genetic determinism implies two things. First, it suggests, indeed it means, that particular genes cause us to do particular things, and there ain't a darn thing we can do about it, as if we were programmed like a fighter plane or a clockwork mouse. Such a belief would indeed be nonsense, but who does believe it? Matt Ridley put the point succinctly in his new book, Origins of Virtue, that genes give rise to instincts, and instincts are nothing more nor less than predispositions. So we have a predisposition to learn our local language and to recognize faces, although we're very poor, for example, at mental arithmetic. We also have particular tendencies to behave in particular ways, in particular circumstances. Neither of these observations suggest any compromise of free will, and still less do they suggest that environment makes no difference. No one can seriously doubt that on the whole men are more aggressive than women. When conditions are particularly bad and stressful, the aggression both of men and women may spill over into murder. But in every society, men commit more murders than women do. In turbulent Detroit, both sexes murder a lot, but men much more. In tranquil Iceland, it seems, men murder very little and women virtually never. Of course, circumstances are all important, and of course, human decision remains crucial. People really are free to decide that they do or do not want to commit murder, whatever their instincts may be urging them to do. So genetic determinism is simply a silly idea. The second threat that the detractors claim to perceive is that of biology-based ethics, the idea that the behaviours to which we are predisposed are necessarily right. But who these days does suggest any such thing? St. Paul pointed out the folly of such a suggestion 1900 years ago. He's forever urging the recipients of his letters to beware their own nature, what he liked to call the lusts of the flesh. David Hume asserted more generally in the 18th century that is does not imply ought. And in 1903, G.D. Moore summarised this whole line of discussion with the expression naturalistic fallacy. It's simply fallacious to argue that a moral code can simply be extrapolated from knowledge of our own biology. That's one of the raw fundamental principles of moral philosophy, and nobody that I know has any trouble with it. But there are some nice subtleties here which people tend to confuse. First, genes themselves are morally neutral. Genes are just replicators, bits of DNA that are good at multiplying themselves. They don't think, and morality, ethics, is the prerogative and the burden of thinking beings. Genes don't think any more than pebbles of the beach, and so they're no more moral. But we are thinking beings, and our genes do influence our behaviour. And all the behaviour of thinking beings, such as ourselves, can and should be subject to moral judgment. Genes are said to be selfish, in Richard Dawkins' metaphor, but as Bill Hamilton and Bob Trivers showed, they can cause us nonetheless to behave in unselfish ways. They do this because they're selfish. They don't give two hoots for the individual that happens to contain them, and a gene that sacrifices its possessor will spread nonetheless if, by so doing, it promotes the survival of its own replicators. But here's the twist. Genes, as good replicators, will sometimes urge us to behave unselfishly, but sometimes urge us to behave selfishly. If the genes themselves were judging what's moral, then they would say that the selfish behaviour is as good as the unselfish, provided it enhances replication. But we in our minds don't say that. We always say that the unselfish behaviour is good, and that selfish behaviour is at best equivocal. And we say that even when we acknowledge that selfish behaviour may sometimes be excusable. Excusable but not good, at best venial. In other words, the standards by which we judge our behaviour, whatever our genes might be urging us to do, are quite independent from, of, and often quite different from, any judgment that the genes themselves might bring to bear if genes were capable of making judgments. And here's another twist. Increasing evidence suggests, if it weren't obvious, that our sense of ethics, our tendency to judge our own and others' behaviour, is itself an evolved capacity. So we can say the following. We have gene-based predispositions to behave in particular ways. Those predispositions sometimes encourage us to behave in ways that we judge to be good, and sometimes in ways that we judge to be bad. And our tendency to pass judgment on our own behaviour is itself a predisposition, an evolved capacity. But we can't say, and nobody is saying, that the criteria we bring to bear when judging our own behaviour are themselves evolved capacities. The criteria we bring to bear come from, well, wherever moral criteria do come from. Where they come from, this question forms much of the stuff of moral philosophy. In short, moral philosophy is alive and well, sublimely unthreatened by evolutionary psychology. The moral philosophers from Moses to G.E. Moore are beyond and beyond are just as important as they always were. So I've suggested that although genes can't and do not tell us what's right and what's wrong, they do predispose us to make judgments. What judgments we make is our own affair. But there is one final twist. Genes are devious things. How do we know that they don't bias our judgments? Actually, it's very likely that they do. Once we see the point of the naturalistic fallacy, then we should also see that we must be prepared to override those biases. But if we are to override those biases, then we have to be aware of them. And this is the point of the whole exercise, to know ourselves. Not to say what's right, but to recognize when we are deceiving ourselves. To see, for example, that our righteous anger is not necessarily righteous at all, but may be an evolved response which we ought, as moral creatures, to put aside. St. Paul regarded human nature effectively as the enemy, and Napoleon said, if you want to win, you must know your enemy. Nobody sensible is trying to derive a morality from a knowledge of biology, but in order to devise a morality that's truly secure, we need to understand our biology, so we know, to put it crudely, what we're up against. Can I have 20 seconds?
Yeah, fast.
The proposal of this place is that Darwinian hypotheses can lead us to understand our own biology more accurately. The extent to which it can do so is unknown, that's what we're trying to find out. There's evidence enough, Daly and Wilson can carry the day all by themselves, to suggest that investigations are useful, and indeed, even at this elementary stage, that they can reduce human misery and save lives. Those who oppose these studies with the crude and inaccurate arguments that they bring to bear, using their academic authority to do so, should, as they say in Yorkshire, think on. Thank you.
Right, well now it's your turn, and I'd be grateful if those who want to ask a question could just put their hands up and I'll point in turn to them, and if you could say who you are and where you come from, it might help just carry the discussion a bit. As I said, a number of people have intimated to me beforehand that they would want to ask questions, and while the rest of you are thinking, could I ask Bob Hine from Cambridge if he would like to ask whatever it was he wanted to ask?
Well, I was interested if the panel would throw light on the distinction between evolutionary psychology, sociobiology, behavioural ecology, and all the other subdivisions of the field, and explain why they spend their time sparring with each other as though they were a religious sect.
Yes, well, there we are. Sam, you want to?
No, not for me.
Not for you, not for you. Colin?
There were people in the audience who could answer this better than I could, but as a preliminary effort, if I get it wrong, people can correct me. My understanding is that sociobiology was the name that was put forward by Ed Wilson in the 1970s to describe what we now call evolutionary psychology. My understanding was that the people who were pursuing it in the 1970s weren't or did not take account of the naturalistic fallacy, the idea of the naturalistic fallacy, although it was pretty old by then. And we're actually trying to say that the behaviour that, as it were, comes naturally is ipso facto right, i.e. men ought to go around philandering and women ought to stay at home in the kitchen. I believe that's what they did say in the 70s. When people came along after Hamilton and after Trivers with a much better theory, and now in the 1980s and 90s, they said to themselves, well, we don't want to be tainted by that sort of old nonsense, so we'll invent a new term for studies that look the same but aren't, because they don't have this moral connotation attached to them, and we'll call that evolutionary psychology. Why they fight like cats, I think, is because they're not very clear in their heads, actually.
Can I suggest a possible reason why they might fight? And that is that, as with any new discipline, it's very uncertain what kinds of criteria of evidence are helpful. I mean, people are still feeling for ways of distinguishing between right things, between ideas that are helpful and thus right, and unhelpful and thus, in quotes, wrong. And while you're uncertain about the methodological part of your methodological base, you tend to get very emotional and fight. But anybody else want to have a suggestion on this point? Are we agreed that the numerous names are actually devices for trying to distance oneself from Spencer H. and yeah. and hit Hitler A. Well, not to mention Britain A. Sorry.
Well, it's all, that's what the whole thing really is about, of course. But I was thinking if I could throw light on it from a completely different discipline, which is probably hardly represented in this room at all, and that is law. I believe that if a judge doesn't want to follow a previous judge, he does something which is called creating a distinction. Now, if somebody wants to practice what is now called evolutionary psychology and doesn't want to read the whole of Herbert Spencer and then write a 1,000-page denunciation of him, but wants to start from present research, he had better find another name. And possibly these fighting is not so much between the people who use these different banners, but people invent new banners in order to escape from the kind of totalitarian sociologists which Colin Judd was too kindly talking about. And I think that is probably where the fighting is.
Right.
Matt Ridley. John. I mean, for those who couldn't hear at the back, John Maynard Smith was pointing out that the quarrelling was either overdone or in the past. Now, can we move on to another topic? Yes.
Question for Colin Fudge. Are you entirely confident that your discipline has nothing to tell the moral philosophy? I'm intrigued by the notion that you can bring forward of evolutionarily stable strategies, which at the very least suggests that there are some genetic parameters that you want to put around the scope of our morality and our political economy.
As it were, the coiner of the expression is in the audience, of course. John Maynard Smith, you wouldn't like to address that. I had this very crude idea, which takes a little bit of time to explain, and I've had a long time already, which is that, as I understand John Maynard Smith's idea, if you have a society like this, you have people behaving, or groups of individuals behaving in two different ways. You can't all behave the same. Well, you can't. If you all behave the same, if you all behave as doves, then you multiply the happiness of the doves by the number of people, and you get the biggest figure. But you're not all going to behave like doves, because hawks are going to grow up who are going to bash the doves. So you always finish up with a position where you've got, let's say, 80% doves and 20% hawks. If you do that, multiply the happiness of the hawks by the number of hawks and the happiness of the doves who are now depressed by the number of doves, and add that up, then the total sum of happiness is less than it would have been if they had all behaved like doves in the first place. And what I wanted to suggest once, and if this is very crude and contracted, is that morality is all about moving from the state of the evolutionary stable strategy where you've got hawks bashing doves up to a point until there were too many hawks, and then they start bashing each other, to the point at which they're all behaving like doves and all behaving the same way. You've got to make that little transition, and that little bit there seems to me what we mean by moral behaviour. It's all very Kantian, really, because Kant's one of his basic notions that we should all behave the same way. And the only way you can all behave the same way and be anything like stable is all to be dovish, but that's not stable because hawks will come in until there's too many hawks. That's the end of my peroration.
Good, right.
Can I just turn to a genuine, if I may use that word, moral philosopher, Michael?
Well, I'm not a moral philosopher. I'm, in this audience, I'm much more like Bottom the Weaver, a kind of comic rustic who speaks his kind of laugh-inducing patois, in my case it's Canadian, to the general amusement of all. I have followed, or attempted to follow, sociobiology's contributions to these subjects for a number of years, since I was shared offices with at King's Cambridge with people who studied seahorses. I think my difficulty with the kind of attempt to find a modus vivendi between moral philosophy and evolutionary psychology is that there's a tendency which I see in some of the things that Colin Tudge says, that he produces a soft theory. And the soft theory says genetics creates instincts which creates predispositions. Once we've got these predispositions, we may go this way, we may go that way. That leaves someone who's in the business of attempting to predict and explain human behavior saying, well, you've taken us just to the point at which it gets interesting. If you get harder and say genetics gives you instincts, gives you predispositions, and then codes the predispositions, it gets interesting, but it's probably untrue, you see? The more ambitious your evolutionary theory gets in terms of actually predicting the outcome of those predispositions, the more up my nose it gets, but also the more interesting. So we could have a truce in which your side says, believe me, we're soft. We're not going to push predispositions very far. And it'll end up with banalities. I mean, interesting ones. Nicer banalities than when Spencer was telling us nature was red in tooth and claw. Now nature is telling us to be nice. But it's the same banality, just with a nicer message. You see, I think that's why the truce we ought to break down and be much less polite with each other. That is, you ought to make stronger claims. I mean, make much stronger inferences from animal populations and fish populations and slugs and God knows what. And for me to say, look, that doesn't work with human beings. It takes me this far to predispositions, to instincts, to I'm extremely keen on all forms of social theory that treat us as bodily creatures. And I think the disembodiment of the human being that you spoke of in the social and moral theory traditions that I come from has led us into a cul-de-sac. It's over-rationalized us in ways that are false. So I'm extremely keen on the dialogue, but don't keep pulling your punches. Because when you keep pulling your punches, you leave me with no propositions that actually take me anywhere. That is, to give you a concrete example, I'm extremely interested in understanding why it is that Serbs kill Croats in 1991, in 1941. Biological theories and genetic theories of human aggression take me, as it were, to the predisposition stage. But then I have to have language, I have to have tradition, I have to have a history, I have to have reflexivity, human consciousness, all the baggage that I'm always dealing with anyway. And I then have to ask myself what exactly the biological explanation of aggression in this specific historical instance tells me that I didn't already know. I'm not unsympathetic, I just want to hear it tell me something that I didn't hear before. Now, to give you an example where it does tell me something, and this may be an example of Bottom the Weaver getting something terribly wrong, but I was absolutely fascinated by Matt Ridley's discussion of the prisoner's dilemma, in which he expounded the possibility that when you play the game once with partners you don't know, you tend to cheat, or you think it pays you to cheat. When you play the game recurrently in a collective situation where there's kind of feedback between you and you learn about each other, you develop the cooperative strategies begin to pay off. It did make me think, oddly, this is again where I'm uncertain whether I'm dealing with a metaphor an analogy or something that's really explanatory of the Serbian-Croatian experiment with cooperation after the death of Tito, when they really did suddenly have to play a new game. And what's interesting is they only played it for a round or two, and everybody cheated. If there'd been more time in the game, it's possible that they would have evolved cooperative strategies, at which point we might have avoided the conflict. Because the game of the Yugoslav presidency was like a prisoner's dilemma game. And it would be interesting, I'm not saying this in a trivial sense, for people to review the historical record of that attempt to collaborate, two ethnic groups to collaborate in a shared institution, and see how they played it, how they cheated, and how it broke down. Because that is where the war started. And it's possible that a prisoner's dilemma analysis would take you enormously much further than the conventional explanations that I'm dealing with. But it's only, in other words, when the theory is coming from, to summarize your side, become hard and make controversial and testing hypotheses, that it becomes interesting. When you're too polite and say, oh no, we're leaving lots of room for motive, lots of room for explanation, lots of room for consciousness, lots of room for choice, I say, you've got to come across the wall, because we've got to get into that mess to make progress.
True. Anybody want to rise to the challenge of going hard on aggression? Yeah. It's certainly true that in the work that Colin referred to by Daly and his co-workers, of course, overwhelmingly, the step parent that abused the child was the male one. I mean, by 1,000 to 1 or more. Yeah.
I can sense a kind of wave of depression sweeping his audience at the prospect of having a perfectly decent meeting hijacked into a discussion of the Yugoslav war, and I promise you, I won't. I just say that I take the point about history, but if I think that the interesting thing about a biological or genetic approach is that it does help you to see something that anybody on the ground in situations of conflict feels palpably, particularly the women and especially the children, but also many of the actors, which is that actions which have historical rationale end up in results of such incredible irrationality for all the actors that everybody has a sense of collective mystery as to how a human population engaged in these actions. In a sense, what if you go back and treat, you know, if you treat the Serbs and Croats as populations of fishes or populations of reindeer or something, you can recover the collective irrationality which the collective irrationality of the consequences that may not have been irrational at the level of intention. And that's why I think any historical explanation ought to be open to biological input and genetic input, simply, as I say, to find some rational explanation for such irrational consequences. To prove my good faith in not wanting to hijack the discussion of Yugoslavia, I did want to pick up the business of stepfathers and because I thought, unless I very much misheard Komtaj, I felt there was a symptomatic lapse in at least one thing he said. It seems to me one thing to claim that stepfathers have 100% greater likelihood of abusing children in their care than natural fathers. It's quite another thing to say, where I thought there was a causative slippage, and I absolutely take the intention behind the point, which is it's absolutely insane if you want to protect children not to take account of the step relationship. But the causation is another story, I would have thought.
But what about accurate is the example anyway, because I would have thought that if natural parents are abusing their children, we're likely to hear rather less than if step parents are abusing
the data set on which it was based were police records in Detroit and in the neighboring Canadian city.
One of the points, sorry, is that
believe you me, what they did take account of it.
Yes.
Sorry,
the point is not that Bailey and Wilson were claiming that it was genetic that caused the step-parents to abuse or kill their children. That clearly isn't the point, because the vast majority
don't. And the importance of this sort of study was that it did change the nature of the recording of the data by the police force and the social services, which was, I mean, a very important thing. And can I just say that one should remember, of course, that any evolutionary explanation is inherently historical. It must be, because evolution is a historical kind of explanation. The problem is that the timescales are so different. And one does have to bear in mind that evolutionary psychology has one terrible flaw in it, and that is it's trying to determine what the selection pressures were of early man, say 100,000 years ago, and the gap between how men and women behave, say, in a hunter-gatherer band with a maximum number of 100 in it, on, say, an African savanna, and how men and women will behave at the next election. There is a slight time problem with trying to carry it across. Yes, right at the back.
Number of years ago on evolutionary economics, and stated that the discipline of evolutionary psychology saw him, I have a set of specific instincts that were trained by experience, not by stimuli, whereas the older view had been that instinct and learning were mutually exclusive. Where is the debate now, and where's the panel?
I wish economists did contribute to this debate, but they don't. They leave it to psychologists. But just speaking as an ordinary layperson who tries to read books on these subjects, I would have thought that learning and instinct are both there and always will be there. And the trick is to study how they interact. And there are many people in the audience who can take this much further than I can.
So I think the answer to your question is that the debate, they're not any longer seen as mutually exclusive.
I want to take Colin Tajak on the subject of moral philosophy and behavioural ecology and evolutionary psychology have nothing to say on the subject. My feeling is there's enormous amounts to say on this subject. The most important thing they have to tell us is that Immanuel Kant is a blind addict. Place to look for inspiration is in David Hume. David Hume, in 1739, already knew everything there was to know about the prison dilemma. He explained reciprocity, he explained that repetition matters, and in particular the Dalhoff game is not a good representation. It only has one evolutionary stage in equilibrium, but the game that humans play, enormous numbers of evolutionary stages. Is what the folk theorem of game theory says in 1954. Enormous number. And if we take this seriously, what we have to learn from this is why did morality evolve in the human species and other species? It's not to take us from an equilibrium to a non-equilibrium, because a non-equilibrium can't be stable. You see, we can't stay there. It's to take us from one equilibrium to another equilibrium where we all have larger differences. And David Hume said this in 1739. 250 years later, the time is ahead.
Matt, you want to come in?
No, I think something like that would help you.
Would you like to ask? Would you like to ask the question that I know you wrote?
Yeah, well, I just about to have you left behind the question about it. Colin said in his introduction, the expert view, which is the case of step-parent views on the first step in the matter, is not shared by the management class. And this is the thing we come across quite often here, that folk wisdom tends to be more in line with the evolutionary psychologist's view than the so-called expert, which I think reveals a bit of a dilemma in how you apply this policy. In a sense, the evolutionary psychology is already factored in, because it's factored into the way man and the jury already thinks, i.e. it's not likely to assume that women are more likely than men to commit rape, for example. So there is no gender blindness in the man on the street. So it's already sort of in that sense factored into the policy application.
The question surely would be, therefore, what besides a pretty story does the evolutionary psychologist bring to the public policy debate? Would you like to try?
Let me try two examples. I think a number of the lessons from evolutionary psychology, as you say, square with common sense. A number of them are actually quite counterintuitive, or quite contrary to common sense. Two simple examples. One is all the evidence of dispositions to eat salt, sugar, fats, etc., etc., which may now be part of our cultural common sense that these are bad for us, but certainly weren't 20 or 30 years ago. And the second is an example which follows up what Michael was talking about in relation to applying prisoner's dilemma questions. I think the best example of this is actually international relations at the moment, where we've moved from a basic structure of international relations based on mutual deterrence, mutually assured destruction, to one based on mutual transparency, where we inspect each other's nuclear weapon sites, chemical sites, have satellites which can see every troop movement, and through achieving that transparency we actually precisely solve the prisoner's dilemma problem which has caused so many wars and so many dispositions to wars in the past. And that too, I think, is counterintuitive. It's not obvious that openness and transparency would have solved the problems of security. In fact, that went precisely opposite to what the public instinct was about national sovereignty, national security, and so on. I want to throw in one problem, though, which is perhaps following up the points about moral philosophy people have been throwing at Colin Tudge. One of the things I think it's legitimate to ask of evolutionary psychologists is whether there are hierarchies of dispositions. And some people claim there are actually hierarchies. James Q. Wilson, for example, tries to put a hierarchy of various dispositions to sociability, notions of fairness, sympathy, and so on. If there are actually hierarchies, and one, in a sense, trumps the other, which explains why people are prepared to form, to be part of Gestapo bands, or in Rwanda, massacring small children, that actually does pose rather important problems for both moral philosophy and for how we actually organise institutions. And I think it's sort of incumbent on the claimants, the advocates, as it were, to answer that.
Can I say something about folk wisdom? It's often better than a priori and politically correct sociology, but that doesn't tell us very much. My admiration for it is a little bit limited, as I have had the experience, it happens with diminishing frequency, as you'll hear, of having to talk to groups of MPs. It doesn't take long before someone gets up in a very red, with a very red face, and says, "It's all very well for you and the small coterie that you write for, but my constituents know that you must spare the rod and spoil the child, or a good hanging does nobody any harm except the man who is hung," and so on and so on. And I do take some comfort in the fact that folk wisdom is contradictory. For instance, fools rush in, for angels fear to tread. On the other hand, faint heart never won fair lady. And my Bielorussian great-great-grandmother once wrote a book, you don't have to believe this, but she once wrote a book of putting together all these proverbs and showing how they contradicted each other. And in fact, she had to publish under a man's name, and you can actually find it in a bookshop under the name of Krylov. The authority for this is my mother.
I must check whether it's in the British Library.
You will find Krylov in the British Library, I'm sure. Okay.
Yes.
I hope that Colin Tudge is right when he says there are no necessary.
Could you speak up a bit or turn round?
I hope that Colin is right when he says that there are no genetic determinants around. And I think it probably has been marked for that. But in relation to what the debate was 20 years ago and what it is now, there has been a significant change, and I agree with you about that. I think that 20 years ago, Ed Wilson effectively said there have been a decoupling the process of development from the study of social behaviour. That's a problem for the future. And by doing so, got rid of one of the most interesting aspects of human behaviour, where all these things come into play. Now, what I wanted to try and develop was a point that Michael Garcia has worked in, or rather, condemning a problem. Once you introduce, once you say that genes and environment are important, then it becomes very soft. It doesn't necessarily become very soft. And I think that's where we need to try and sharpen up the argument. Because it can be the case that one can produce very specific mechanisms which are highly predetermined in some senses, that are gathering information from the environment in particular kinds of ways, which then lead to particular kinds of outcomes, and they may work in particular situations and not in other situations. It's that I would like to hear a bit more about from the panel. I mean, I put down as a question, in fact, something which I think is in a way bearable. I've been interested for a long time in the issue of whether the claim that evolutionary biology has something to say about insect species was sustainable. I mean, whether it is indeed the case that what we recognize as a prohibition on behavior grew out of an inhibition. It's well known that our animals, indeed ourselves, will avoid mating with close relations if we have a chance. and it's also well known that there are prohibitions against it. Now, what's the link? And how does one come right, give rise to the other? And that, if we ask that kind of question, that raises very interesting issues about the interplay between human traditions and culture.
I mean, when you ask what the link is, I mean, you mean something more than the fact that if you run a simulation over a long time, then incest is genetically deleterious.
Yes, but it doesn't follow from that that you should have incest to do.
Exactly.
Well, Robert, yeah.
I cannot bear this whole debate should rest on the supposition that there are some things that the Darwinian model predicts, and then you stop and you go on to all the old things that the social scientists have dealt with all these years. Nor can I bear the implied distinction between what the sociobiologists predict and what they just call culture. Culture is made by individuals who have evolved under the force of natural selection, and the propensity and the complications of the social scientists are complications that are consequences of aspects of human psychology that have been selected for by natural selection. That doesn't mean that the outcome of all the interplay between these complicated human characteristics that have been evolved by natural selection will be adapted to anybody else. They may be maladaptive, but the initial propensities are adapted, and you can't put culture out there as something that's involved. Culture influences us as we create culture, and both we and culture are perceived as not an entity but as processes in continual creation through the agency of this dialectical relation between and speech. Sorry.
No, I.
If you get the name, if you know the people of
future. It would just help, I think, if I introduced Patrick Bateson from Cambridge, who's debating with his fellow colleague from... Could you say who you are?
Oh, yes, right. My name is Mr. Brunt. I'm telling you. But what I'm not. I'm not a scientist. Anyway, what I am, I suppose, is a conservative party politician on the local level, on the way forward, to be involved in local government. Mm-hmm. And we're very practical, and what we're pulled up. Now, my main point is really is to try and stress very much the reason why I believe that culture is the overwhelming interest. And I would like that, if I may, for 1 minute, to refer to the particular two conflicts which you mentioned, Serbs and Croats. Now, in the case of Serbs and Croats, the Serbs their Christianity from Constantinople. They are Greek Orthodox. The Croats took their Christianity from Italy, which, in other words, they are Roman Catholics. Now, ethnically, they're very much the same. Furthermore, now, in their history, most of Serbia was from independent parts of the Turkish Empire, from Tata of Belgrade, for very many centuries. Most of Croatia was part of Austria during many centuries. So the cultural difference is therefore enormous. And really, they also, in a way, probably not totally similar from Northern Ireland. They're also, because I know Northern Ireland, I've been there once, they're also, there's a cultural difference between the Roman Catholic and the Protestant. They go to different schools, they go to different parts, they mix with different people, although they get everything that has any meaning, that and therefore genetically they're much the same. It's those circumstances, as regards the Hutus and the Tutsis, they're also the foreign people, history, and foreign volume, and that impact in my mind is changing far better than all this theorizing about the genetics or anything like that. And that is, the Tutsis, who came to that part of Africa about 250 years ago, they are fairly slaves to all, from a native cattle herder, who set themselves apart as the rulers of that part, and who oppressed the Hutus for 2.5 centuries. As a result, first of all, he's considered to be seen as a therefore, not in one, not in the simply saying that my own personal belief and I also talk to the people of the past that we've had in my mind a constant influence which is then not imposed, not that they chose, but the external circumstances, the proact took their Christianity particularly because of the big monkeys between them and the inner part of the world, and the church of their Christianity and the church didn't ask to be used by the church, but they happened.
But yes, it's the back there.
But thank you very much. Surely the predisposition that you began by talking about is to be wary at a time to meet the other tribes.
Yeah.
However you call it, Jews, Christians, Catholics, Buddhists, Persians, the range of 7 billion is huge. But within our genetic makeup, there is a predisposition to me that we draw back from the other universe. The other way of working, the other accent, the other religion, the other tribal background, and to center on the full circle, go out there.
Yes, I mean, it's some.
Why the question of intergroup people, what you're talking about, is huge.
And groups will define themselves, however. I mean, someone pointed out you could imagine fights between those who started their boiled eggs at the pointed end or the rounded end.
Called
yes.
Swift.
That's right.
The fact of it is that the countries often try to shy away from conflict. I mean, the way in which the Second World War came about was that there were a whole lot of countries, including this one, that refused to go to the aid of those countries, like China, like Abyssinia, like Albania, like Austria, like Czechoslovakia, that were being attacked. So the idea that we all always try to get involved in some kind of conflict because there is a kind of Darwinian predisposition for it, I think it's simply false. I think there's another question that has to be answered. Why is it that some groups conflict, if you're talking about the Serbs and the Croats, but other groups do not? You talk about the Slovenes and the Croats. And why is it that some groups conflict at certain times and not at other times? Why is it that sometimes their conflicts result in war, but at other times they don't? And the most important question, why isn't there war all the time?
Well, yes, I mean, yes.
Well, I haven't lived.
Yes.
I'm not sure there's much of a question.
Could you say who you are?
Yeah, I'm Jay, and I'll be a man in the pub later.
Right.
I'm not sure there's much of a question, but I'm already I studied psychology, and my sort of favourite topic would be political psychology. And so I'm already sort of but there was it didn't bring me much happiness in some ways. I mean, I'm sitting with it, I can't sort of get rid of it now. Such a powerful framework to sort of put my life in. But, I want to sort of say, you know, like if people sort of had a Bible came back, I'm not sort of going on to say that, but the people who sort of wrote the Bible, had the Bible kind of got here, I suppose they had like a framework that people would be thinking about their lives with a view to having like a good society against it. And I wonder whether like evolution, it makes you conscious of motives and behaviour about yourself and looking at other people. It's a very cold framework in many ways. I mean, I think it's a very true framework, but it's quite a cold one. And I don't think it necessarily evolved to functionally be aware of it. And what I mean to say is that I think that at the end of the day, evolution theory is going to make you great if it's decided to about something. And it's going to have, you know, people are going to have sort of this framework of their lives and function in society. And it might be we'll sort of become aware of it, become aware of the motives coming up, and then moral philosophy kind of sort of we work out a really good society. But it might not, it just might sort of tear us apart. And we might even be predisposed to not want to be aware of our motives. And this might be part of the resistance which evolution psychology is running into, which is sort of safe society. And I just wondered, you know, I mean, the question really is this a dangerous idea that's likely to be rejected in some kind of immunological way?
Is the knowledge dangerous?
Is the knowledge dangerous?
I think such a powerful framework at the end of the day, going to function much as the Bible's done in the past. Now, I don't understand what the Bible calls about happiness, but like you almost have to, like, I don't know if people think Bible's trying to say, well, we want to have a good functioning. I mean,
if what you're saying is knowledge dangerous, then in one sense, that's the problem with knowledge. I mean, it often can be.
Yes, at the back.
My name is Greg Burnham, I'm a journalist, and I'm interested in this area. And there's something I've observed since the sea change in the last year, is that about a year ago, people who were writing about Jewish psychology, particularly from a worried or concerned angle, stressed very much the conservative trend, in fact, that it's very often encouraged the idea that there were some inherited the aggression of males and the nurturing quality of females, but it was somehow a reactionary doctrine that encouraged the right, if you like. And of course, in a metaphorical way, you have the selfish genes and the Thatcherite selfish greedy society. I realize that's not a sort of statistic, but you know, in terms of the general feeling, Darwinian psychology seems to fit in with that kind of go out and get it for yourself. And I've been interested in over the last year, which is sort of a key example, is that the ethos of it seems to have shifted to the idea of the society and the need for cooperation and altruism and some of these other qualities, which again seems to be reflected in a social, otherwise a social cultural sense. And I wondered if anybody wants to pick up that idea, whether there was that sort of interaction.
I'll rise to that. I usually rise to these difficult things, but I think Collins has said it all in his opening remarks, that you cannot derive an ought from an is. And if these studies seemed a year ago to be encouraging to one political faction and today seem encouraging to another, that is no argument against pursuing them. In fact, the probability is that the inferences that both sides are making are wrong. I think that I'm a journalist myself, and there's a terrible danger that we journalists see everything from, well, I'm a Jewish journalist, and I grew up among people who said, if they heard of some change in the Kremlin, is it good for the Jews, or is it bad for the Jews? And there is a terrible tendency among academics to say, does it help Thatcherism, or does it knock a few nails into it? And I'm getting fed up to the teeth with it. It's worse than the University of Oxford. And I would suggest that social scientists, political theorists, and everyone in this field should employ a self-denying ordinance. First of all, do not mention the name Thatcher. He's not been Prime Minister for 6 years. Do not mention it in the next year. Secondly, if you can't follow this, and you must, find chapter and verse. And thirdly, then, only use it if you've ever actually met the lady. I mean, it is there is nothing that is having a worse influence on in this aspect of the academic world, which I know about, unlike biology, than seeing everything in terms of a right-left conflict. And isn't there something to be said for first following ideas and seeing where they lead, and afterwards asking, does it lead us to modify our political views in one direction or another?
Michael? I think there is some... While I agree with Samuel Britton, I think there's also something to what the questioner was suggesting. And there is a kind of Matt Ridley is kind of Blairite biology. I mean, as much as he may recoil from this dubious pairing, and there may be something in the zeitgeist that produces a caring and sharing biology just when we need it. I mean, I'm a historian here, and I don't, I think that there's simply no doubt that there are elective affinities unseen and unfelt between purely scientific theories, particularly when they're popularized, and the historical environment in which they appear. Newton gets to work, and then it's popularized, and it's picked up, and it rides with one chariot, and then it rides with another chariot. And in a sense, the productivity of theories can be determined by their promiscuity. If they ride with all the chariots, you know that everybody wants them and wants to exploit them for their own purposes. And it's clear that no scientific theory should be judged simply because Adolf Hitler was fond of it, or Tony Blair was fond of it, or anybody was fond of it politically, or so put it, political use. And I don't like the prohibitions that have been put on sociobiology, for example, on the left of the political debate, simply because it's supposed to endorse, you know, the idea that all men are aggressive or whatever. My problem is at a much prior level, which is that I'm still struck by the extraordinary primitiveness of these theories in their work when it comes to actually explaining human behavior. My problem is not that I'm unsympathetic to what they're trying to do, is that they're not delivering me what I very much want them to deliver, which is explanations which treat human beings as reflexive, conscious, choosing people. I mean, we were talking earlier with what I thought was appalling looseness about group aggression, as if you could analyze human ethnic, inter-ethnic conflict or inter-tribal conflict as if it was a conflict between populations of fishes or populations of animals. I mean, the characteristic that makes the explanation of human aggression difficult is that group identities are self-chosen and self-selecting to an appalling degree. The so-called Serbs who are fighting the so-called Croats are ethnically and genetically mixed to an appalling degree. They are self-constituted groups, and it's their self-constitutedness which is crucial. One of the areas which, for example, where I would like help from biologists is in exploring something that Freud called the narcissism of minor difference. Freud predicted that the smaller the real differences between groups, the more likely would it be for them to come in conflict. It's a paradoxical theory. The less that really distinguishes you, the more likely you're about to fight. So that the man at the back who said, well, it's genetically natural for us to repel or be repelled by the other, is missing the much more interesting thing, that we're actually repelled by what is most similar to us. It's precisely because Hutu and Tutsi are actually, you know, within a kind of some infinitesimal percentage identical that produces the conflict. Well, that's a finding, I think, of social science. What you then want is for an evolutionary biologist to do studies which compare conflicts between groups according to whether they're significantly different from each other or less different from each other. Now, if there was biological evidence from animal populations that said the more similar the two groups of fishes, the more likely they are to fight. And if, you know, if the fishes have really different colorations and really different spots and really different kind of ecologies, they won't fight, then I would feed that back into the study of human populations. But what would I do with it? Is this a metaphor? Is this an analogy? Or is this an explanation? You see, we're still just beginning the argument. In other words, I would find what a biologist says to me about animal populations deeply interesting, but I'm still not sure whether it would explain or whether it would simply be metaphorically interesting. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. One sentence in defense, I don't disagree with the syllable you've already done.
Yes.
I'm sorry to have been loose and not to be precise. What I meant to say was that it seems to me that there is an unfortunately powerful pre-existing issue.
Yeah, well, I've got two people I've been catching my eye for a long time. Right at the back, yes.
Evolution psychology condensed itself
in contrast to the social science, and in contrast to the failure of social science to understand aspects of human nature and human behaviour, and in contrast to subjectivist, relativist development of social science. Yet it seems to me, if you look at the philosophical underpinnings of both evolution, psychotics, and social theory, there are net commonalities between them. Taking some examples, for example, the hostility to enlightenment notions of human nature, a critique of humanism and user, a critique of the subject, the notion of limits to human potentiality, and so on. And is it not the case then that what evolution psychology does is it takes a common wealth assumption, common because they are of our age, and grounds them in a seeming certainty of science. And rather than say that this is evolution psychology, this is social science, and thinking that they are both inflected by common preoccupation, common uncertainty, and what evolution psychology does is take them and give them the seeming certainty of science.
Do you want to respond to that question?
Only that I don't know who gave the impression that sociology and evolutionary psychology were being placed in opposition. Just to make the point that there certainly are people here, sociologists, who are very busily, as it were, throwing Darwinian hypotheses at standard sociological models and seeing what comes out. That seems a very fruitful thing to do.
Jonathan, could you say who you are?
It's Jonathan Rosen has on the Slowly Comics. But I'd like to return to the question of the apparent movement of environmental psychology come up towards the centre from its previous perception. I don't think this should be too surprising. It is, I think, fairly commonsensical that ideas about society should in some way be related in the context to use in science and social science to understand it, and therefore that the ideas about society affected by the material base of society should be reflected in scientific theory. We have, after all, in this context, the well-known borrowing ideas from Malthus by Darwin, Malthus taking his ideas from British economy of that period, and Darwin finding those a useful insight into the behavior of nature. Now, if that is what's the case in the 19th century with Darwin, why should we not assume that it's the case now? Should not the practitioners of his subject be more reflective about where their ideas are and their apparently up to the status?
Yeah.
Toby Andrews, I'm interested in this question about the relationship between social sciences and natural sciences today, because can say, so what, sociologists are throwing Darwinian ideas at social problems, but it's quite a phenomenal development, really, because way back when in the 70s, the very same people who would have been chasing the Earwolves and Brown campus calling them fascists are now taking up these ideas and in all sorts of ways. Now, a really interesting example in the Vemos magazine of Robert Wright. I think a fairly correct point that Darwinian or evolutionary psychology ideas really should be a flavour of the decade, whatever, amongst feminists. And in his book, he points out that this is the philosophy of the 90s that the postmodernist social constructionists should love, because it's a naturally kind of nihilistic outlook. What I think has facilitated this, and it's not just, I think it is a new development, there is, this new synthesis developing. I think it's too much to rest this development on the one premise that evolutionary theory has quite rightly proud of itself as it developed these new ideas. But it's not sufficient an explanation as to why this kind of new development has come about. I think it's much more to do with the fact that social sciences, and it doesn't matter whether you believe in genes or society today, what everyone believes in is that nothing, you can't change anything. And that's what's appealing about these ideas, I think, at the end of the day. Times with the idea that, at least these people have got a sense of limitation, and they've got the benefit of having some scientific kudos, whereas these sociologists, quite rightly again, have discredited the
themselves, very silent.
Oh, God, I mean, the thought that I'm a postmodernist at last is quite horrifying. Yes.
John Hopcraft from the IRC. So I wanted to touch on this issue on social change. I'm not clear that evolutionary psychology yet offers an anything in terms of social change. I think what it's likely to offer is an understanding of a wider range of constraints and predispositions under which we operate, which, if anything, is going to make the task of the social scientist a stronger one. Because the social change that you observe is operating on the basis of those natural constraints. It seems to me that in terms of what causes change, we're not likely to get very much of that, even though we might have different possible adaptation codes and tools. But nevertheless, understanding some of these limitations may in fact come about so we can understand what causes social change and the strengths of things that have to happen in order for that to occur.
Yeah. Gerard Fairplay is my name. I'd like to ask the panel whether they think that the term evolutionary psychology may be causing some of the confusion, because it combines evolution and psychology. Now, if what psychology is doing is telling us about human nature, then surely to anyone concerned with social science or politics, to know more about human nature can only be helpful. It may, as you say, as the last speaker said, introduce constraints that some people might not like. But if they are justifiable constraints, we better know about them. So there is a very good case to know about psychology. And if evolutionary arguments help us to do that, that's great. But what seems to be introduced, partly perhaps by the use of that, is that evolutionary analogies are introduced into social explanation, which is a completely different thing. But in quite a lot of the remarks made here this evening, the two have been blended together. If they are kept apart, I think we would have clearer thinking. And I'm not saying that evolutionary arguments might not be evolutionary analogies. Biological analogies might not be useful in social science, but it's a completely different thing from using evolution to understand psychology.
Does anyone? I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think there is a very real confusion, and the added confusion that one finds is when economists use Darwinian analogies and talk about firms competing for niches. And just import all those technical terms in a way which is not apparent whether they're really meaning them as metaphor or analogy or as explanation.
Right. I couldn't agree less.
Good.
Robert, going back to Durkheim and all this business about social phenomena can only be explained at the social level. And that's what we've got to get away from. Every time a Catholic goes into a Catholic house in Northern Ireland, he's maintaining the culture. Every time a cleric goes into a cleric cathedral or whatever it is that he's doing, he's doing the same. The question we've got to ask is why are they doing that? And they're doing it for a variety of reasons. Partly because of group processes which have been adapted in these religions. Partly because of the propaganda which is put about as being a good cleric or a good Catholic. Partly because of their own assertiveness, they want to be the best in their group and show up in the past and show that they're alive. All of these things are aspects of human psychology which have been adapted by humans. What one's got to do is find the right level of analysis in which to apply the Darwinian principles to human behavior and then see how that human behavior produces the elaborate
Can we push a little hard on the question of survivalism? Whenever I read the psychology of the past, I usually find them terribly boring. They carry with them, for example, the rather convincing. And yet at the end of the day, I'm saying to myself, what is the the message of words, how do I try to make it true? I get stuck because it has a very possibility of transparency, but it is not difficult to see the falsifiable proposition in which actually assessment in some way. Now, just take your example of these Michaels, for example, of the two groups, the more similar they are, the more problem they seem to do. Well, I can't think of non-evolutionary explanation for that, but probably they're quite convincing, because the more similar groups are, the more likely they are to want the same thing, the more likely they are to find themselves the same geographical part of the world, and so the more likely they are to stop them at death at all. We don't need any kind of evolutionary explanation for that.
But that is very close to an evolutionary explanation, actually.
Simply because it requires just an assumption that people can kill themselves.
No, because you could say that was... We are the survivors of people who acted like that, and therefore we continue to act like that.
You could also say, on the whole, most living organisms will consume their own self-interest. That may be a genetic statement, but it's not actually fundamental. And then the second example, I think it's after the sexual, it's actually quite tight. It is quite good. Although, even there, you could think of it. In many cases, they don't form sense of relationship. You can think of environmental reasons why. And I wonder about the panel conference, both of both Jeff Mulligan and Colin raised this, about how are we really in a situation where we're getting a really large number of falsifiable propositions that at the end of the day are going to be tested in a certain way and hence all the
problems. It does seem to me that if you're going to make any sort of robust predictions about anything complicated in social behaviour, then you've got to have then the business of testing it and making it falsifiable is going to be very difficult indeed. And that's possibly one answer to Michael's point that the progress seems to have been slower than he'd like, but it really is very hard to be robust. On the point of the specific point, for example, about the stepchildren, there are loads of confounding variables, all of which Wilson and Daly looked at very carefully. For example, length of, how long you've known the child. There was very, very small evidence, but they looked at it. But if the stepfather was actually there when the mother gave birth and was actually on the scene during the pregnancy and was there at birth, his violence towards the children was even greater. I mean, only marginally, but even greater than it would have been than was usual. I mean, they did look at these things at the point, so there are robust hypotheses which are tested. But there are people here, for example, Geoffrey Miller sitting there, whose whole life is dedicated towards finding hypotheses of big questions which can be tested. I don't know whether anybody thinks that he might address the issue of how you do it. But of course it's crucial, yeah, it's very hard.
I'll come to you in a minute, Geoffrey, I may.
Well, I just wanted to say that Karl Popper, whose name has been mentioned several times, actually thought that grand evolutionary theory was metaphysical in a benign sense, because he thought it was that the theory of natural selection was not itself falsifiable, but it did give birth to a lot of lower level falsifiable theories, such as that about stepchildren. Now, I was a little surprised that Julian Grant asked that question, because he has probably carried out as many such surveys as anyone in this room, and he knows far more than I do about controlling for the influence of various variables. And you could, I mean, as we say, it's been done, but surely anyone doing this would actually make a subclassification according to how long these step parents have known the children and compare them with natural parents with the same degree of knowledge. And I'm not going to tell you, Julian, how to do econometrics and similar and its analogues in the other social sciences. I was just quite surprised that you thought a competent study wouldn't look at these complicating instances.
Hey, come on.
just very...
I just think that the stepchildren study was quite good.
I mean, there's plenty of falsifiable hypotheses around in terms of things like mate selection. The issue of dialect differentiation in denser populations is actually probably a better example of small differences and actually the generation of small differences rather than responses to them, which can be given a fairly strong evolutionary psychology explanation. The one domain where it seems to me, A, there aren't any falsifiable hypotheses, and I suspect there won't be any, is on the issues we've been, I think, rather diverted on to, which are the Rwanda-Yugoslavia type ones, which are about tribalism, which is often used in the sort of the pop versions of evolutionary psychology. But precisely because we cannot derive any conclusions about the scale of group from understanding the environment of evolutionary adaptation, when, as John said earlier, the likely size of group was 100 or 150, to extrapolate that to nations, large ethnicities, seems to me wholly spurious, and I cannot imagine any falsifiable hypothesis being generated from evolutionary psychology to all these things we've actually spent quite a lot of time talking about.
But Jeff, do you want to come in on the falsification point?
I think a lot of confusion arises from the fact that evolutionary psychology is the first framework that psychology has had that doesn't actually have any content of itself. It's just a way of thinking about possible mechanisms that the mind might have. Freudian psychology had content and was falsifiable. Behaviorist psychology had content and was falsifiable. All that evolutionary psychology delivers, if it's practiced by good people, is our hypotheses about mechanisms and possible environmental influences on behavior and age and sex differences and so forth. And one very strange thing about it is that it's actually practiced now by very, very few people. I mean, the amount of coverage it gets is vastly greater as a proportion of the number of practitioners than any previous branch of psychology. And the mechanisms, the hypotheses, don't look falsifiable until you have enough graduate students working in the field to falsify. So remember that there are only probably 30 active evolutionary psychologists in Britain and probably about that many in the US. And they don't look like a very scientific field until that increases by several orders of magnitude.
Yes.
Can I say, I mean, one reason why I found this interesting is evolution psychology is just about sex. And people like read about sex, and especially about public stories about sex. And one of the things on this issue of what psychology I wanted to ask the panel about was one of the in the CMOS publication, the one piece of this, I don't know whether it's described as a script, but the hypothesis we put forward, which presumably shouldn't have all psychology of applied to it, is the one to do with political view as being a form of sexual display to make selection, and that the going around in universities or such reality declaring that you're a radical is a way of telling potential mates that either you're a caring and nurturing person who's going to be good for bringing up children, or you're going to be someone who's going after resources and is going to be good for bringing up children and providing them with a lot of money and stuff. And I wonder whether it felt that this sort of theorizing is useful or whether it felt something we didn't know.
Yes, in my youth it was the young conservatives who filled this role. But
well, that is one of the articles in the Demos Quarterly which I've so far had time to read from beginning to end. Now, as it was, as reported there, it would be difficult to falsify, but it could be developed into something falsifiable. I mean, it didn't say just that radicalism was fashionable, conservatism. If done in that way, everyone would be attractive who had political views of some kind, because he would be bringing up a family in some way. The question that the author asks, and he's probably here correctly if I'm wrong, is that why is it that suddenly people, I think, in the University of Illinois, who had never shown any interest in South Africa for decades past, suddenly became preoccupied with apartheid, and it became a concern that it became a sort of signal, and an undergraduate who wasn't taking in a very active part in anti-apartheid demonstrations was below the salt and not worth considering. I remember thinking when I was in short trousers how unjustifiable the treatment of coloured people in South Africa was, and I could never get anyone to take an interest in it for decades until suddenly people were talking about nothing else. So there is clearly, and it's not in, I mean, I don't know if evolutionary or Freudian or some other psychology would be the, provide the best explanation of it. But I think there is a Freudian distinction between latent and overt behavior. And it's, there is something, there was something going on there which was more than ethical abhorrence of what was going on in South Africa, which itself was justified, but there were other horrors going on in other parts of the world, and the South African apartheid system had been in operation many years before. There is something to study there. I don't think, to use a horrible word, that the author established causality, and I don't think it's yet falsifiable, but I think that line of investigation could lead to some testable hypotheses.
I wanted to pick up something that Jeff Mulgan said a minute ago. It seems to me of great methodological importance, or raises the important methodological question. I mean, about what size of population is, you know, evolutionary psychology relevant? I mean, if you're saying to me, this is not a discipline that has relevant things to say about populations as large as the ones that are involved in ethnic and tribal conflict, that's an important self-denying ordinance, which to my knowledge, the kind of socio-biological popularization that I've been exposed to hasn't observed. I mean, if you're saying it should observe it, that's an important methodological self-limiting device, but it then leads to a further problem, which is you've got in Demos the obvious expectation that evolutionary psychology will have policy implications. Well, what's the population field of policy recommendations? It's nations, tribes, and countries. So you, if you're saying this is a field of a field which in human population should really deal with individual behaviors or small group behaviors, in analogy to you know, individual behaviors or small group behaviors in animal populations, that's fine. But I think the discipline itself has got to clarify what size of subject it can take on.
I mean, my hunch is that it will not be that helpful for understanding ethnic conflict or nationalism. But for a range of other policy issues, one of which, for example, we looked at last year, which was charity and volunteering, practical altruism, I can imagine all sorts of ways one would generate fairly easily testable hypotheses which would give you insights about which age groups, which genders, in which conditions would act in that way. Can I just make one point on the politics issue, and perhaps Geoffrey Miller can come back on this, and the sort of so what question. One possible answer to that, I was very struck this year going to all the party conferences, that at the Labour Party conference their youth wing was roughly 50-50 male and female, at the Conservatives it was roughly 9-10 male to female. Now, I wonder if one should therefore predict on that basis that young Tories are going to go in a further phase of decline, because in a sense their mating utility is so low. But
it's not like the young Conservatives that I remember it. Yes, sir.
One of them has been known is conscription.
Conscription.
Yes, if you want men to fight, you have to know the complicated rates, anything, maybe the easy way out, or the passive way out, to get his fighting. And it's interesting, and there's also much discussion, I don't see it this evening, seems to proceed the supposition that women don't exist. Not they're bad or fear, but they don't exist. And it's notable, as it were, on the whole feminist movement, don't seem to cry out that women don't have enough opportunity to say that we expose the machine gun fire, or that three or the too few women are in the military graveyard and things like that. Finally, was that Iceland? That was settled, I understand, by Vikings and their Celtic big slaves, both pretty warlike populations. You know, roughly 1,000 years. They've been pretty well isolated for war, and they don't seem to show gross abnormality. They don't understand Icelandic society. They don't show gross abnormality to behaviour. They can be attributed presumably to denial of what is aggression. And we haven't even looked at Iceland.
Gosh, yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Discussion about, you know, whatever missionary psychology can or cannot do. But look back to Neil Wilson. Neil Wilson always talked about cruel evolution. So let's not just talk about biological evolution, simultaneously talk about social evolution, cultural evolution. And
is really essential that we do this. And that in response to your remarks about economists not understanding their illusion, in economics we actually are constructive, as best we can, models of learning by imitation, learned behavior, trying to build those in with psychological models of reinforcement. And until we start taking seriously the fact that there's not only biological evolution that's important, but also cultural evolution. How does cultural evolution differ from biological evolution? It isn't true, actually, that it's just a matter of myth, of course. We like models of these things. There are some straightforward things which are the same in both theories, and there are other things which are different. And our problem as scientists is to try to distinguish between these things. So this is sort of, it seems to me, this concentration on the biological issues here is a mistake, and obviously they're fundamental. But we've got to go back to the fundamentals and think about how does cultural evolution work.
Yes, I was criticising the economists who didn't make it clear what they were doing. I'm
well aware they are doing it.
Now, I think just time for one more question. John, we ought to give it to you.
I wanted to slightly query a view that I think all members of the panel have said on it and seem to share, which is that there's something deeply different between the psychological mechanism that could lead conflict between small groups and the psychological mechanism today underlying conflict between large groups. Maybe so, which is not obvious. There is quite a different psychological work at the moment, partly influenced by the strategy, the way that even quite small groups pick up on the basis of what they're called badges of some type, not genetic badges, but special things that are put upon them, which are called cultural currencies. And it continues to look horribly as if it's true that one of the things that is involved there is to pick up stuff on the basis and not make acquired later. And I don't see why that shouldn't be just as relevant as Bosnia as it is on foot.
Well, as a student of John Smith, I wouldn't answer him. I just say I'm encouraged to hear him say that I didn't quite agree with Jeff, actually, because my one of my motives in delving a little into these areas was to try to find something out of our groups. And if I can give another example, and again Professor Maynard Smith will be able to correct it in detail, but in Constantinople 2,000 years ago, the emperors carried out a process of divide and rule, and they simply divided the population into blues and greens. Now, according to one theory, it was according to where they sat in the stadium, but according to another, they simply had a tape through the city. But either way, they actually started killing and massacring each other. And may I suggest a hypothesis which can be, which could be falsified, but it won't be because nobody will allow the experiment to take place. If this audience were divided into two halves by some natural catastrophe, say one of these minor earthquakes, so that two sides of the room began to diverge, and it well then wasn't safe for them to go home, and they had to live in student accommodation, and they gradually got to know each other better, and but their contacts with the other side became less. Eventually, all kinds of loyalties and aggressive feelings would develop, and there might be a time, Chairman, when you would be called back to try to do what you can to reduce the level of violence between the blues and the greens. And it would be based on nothing at all. And of course, school teachers have always known this. They've divided pupils according to houses, and sometimes this has got out of hand.
In American schools, they tried dividing children by eye color to try and teach them about discrimination, and found it so traumatizing to them that, in fact, it's been, I think, it's banned as an aid for teaching. The point I was trying to make, though, is not that there aren't similarities between group identification at different scales, but what one wants to know is which differences people are using at different moments and how that changes, whether it is that of an ethnic group, a nation, a religion, a whole variety of different things. And that's where questions of scale are crucially important. and crucially under-theorized both by sociology and by evolutionary psychology.
Looking at the clock, I think it's time for me just to say to the panel, is there anything, any final thought they would like to have? A short one? Not even a long one. Michael?
This is the first panel I've ever been on at which the panel has really learnt a great deal from the audience.
Well, it then falls for me formally to draw things to the close, and there are a number of things I must do in so doing, if you'll just bear with me for a couple of minutes. The first is to thank all the members of the panel, who I think have been rather brave. The second is Oliver Curry, who, as I pointed out earlier, has done a lot of the donkey work with editing this quarterly, and I certainly am extremely grateful to him. And Gay Wolven, who, wherever she is, there she is, who did all the organisation, for which many thanks. And I tell you, organising anything in the LSE, I speak with passion and knowledge, is difficult. Now, there will be drinks. Where are the drinks, Helena? There'll be drinks. Oh, I see, there's even an arrow. There'll be drinks if you follow the arrow from 7 until 7.30, when those who wish to can purchase copies of this quarterly, which will be on sale, price £5, Jeff?
What is that?
Yes.
Price £5. I think that covers everything, doesn't it? That's everything I should have said? In that... The student... Follow the signs, top floor of the student cafe if you get lost. It finally remains for me to thank you, the audience, for, as Sir Samuel Britton said, educating us all. Thank you very much.